Rumije asks that we look at the way that the six Pramitas, or transcendent perfections, are presented in this text, the ornament of the Mahayana Sutras. And he's taught recently from the different presentations, four main ones, which he gave us the reading transmission for this morning. And I'll just kind of go through them in a brief way. I don't think we probably won't get to finish them all, but I don't think that's so important, because we'll get through sort of the main ones, and the one that repeats itself over and over again, well, we can just know is the same for all of them, so it's not a big deal to go through each one of those one by one. So I'd like to start with the one that is about the seven ways that they're free from attachment, because I think that's really interesting. The root verses say almost the same thing every time, but in fact they're referring to seven different ways in which these practices are free from attachment. So for example, the first one is generosity, and it says, due to their generosity, bodhisattvas are not attached, will not be attached, and are free from attachment. It is also the case that they are not attached. Not attached, will not be attached, and are free of attachment. So there's seven different times that they're not attached, and each one of them is referring to something different. So for example, in the first one, when it says that they're not attached, that means that they're not attached to the opposite of the practice of generosity, which is avarice or greed, like miserliness. And what makes us have that feeling of clinging to what we have is when we think that it's real. When we think that what we possess is something real, then we get attached to it and we don't want to give it away. But the bodhisattvas know that what they have is not real. They know that whatever material things they might possess, they're just like things in a dream. And so they have no problem in giving them away to whoever needs them, including even their own body. So that's why Rinpoche quoted from this other text by Chandrakirti when he said that the sign of a bodhisattva who's perfected the practice of generosity is someone who's who's able to happily give away their own body, gives away their own flesh. But not only that, they give it away with a smile on their face. And they don't, because bodhisattvas don't suffer any pain. Once they've reached the bodhisattva bhumis, they can cut off their limbs and give them away without feeling any suffering. And the reason why they can do that is because they've directly realized emptiness. And so they have this direct experience of their body being just like an illusion. And so cutting it into pieces doesn't cause them any kind of suffering. Which is quite an amazing thing when you think about it. So anyway, that's the first kind of way that they're not attached, is that they're not attached to the opposite of generosity. The second is that they're not attached to postponing or procrastinating their act of generosity. Meaning that if somebody asks them for something, they don't think, well, I'll just do it later. I don't have to do it now. I'll have another chance some other time to help this person, so I can wait. So they don't take that attitude, so they're not attached to procrastinating. And then the third way that they are not attached is that they don't put any limit on on their generosity. They're not attached to thinking, I've done enough, you know, this week or this month or this year. I don't need to give any more. You know, I've already given. I gave at the office. And they're not attached to thinking, well, you know, this person is good to give to, but this other person, they don't really need my help. Or I'll give to this group of people from this country, but not to this group. You know, or I'll give when they don't have any attachment to time, so I'll give when I'm not tired and when I feel good and I feel I can do it, but if I can't, if I don't feel up to it, then I just won't. So they don't have those types of attachments to limits on their practice of generosity. That's the third kind. The fourth is that they're not attached to a hope for a good response from the person to whom they give. And this is such a huge one for us, because our normal way is we always are looking for some kind of response from the person to whom we think we do something nice for. We want them to, you know, give us a nice pat on the back or something at least. And in that way, our generosity is more like a business transaction than it is a real act of generosity, because we're looking for something back. It's like a deal we're making with the other person. We'll give to you if you give to me. But the bodhisattvas practice true generosity because they don't have any hope or desire from a good response from the beings to whom they're giving. Then the fifth kind is that they're not attached to having a good result come sometime down the line, meaning that this refers to the way that karma works. And it's certainly the case that if we do something good for others, then the result we'll experience is good. But the bodhisattvas don't think about that when they practice generosity. And they're not looking, they know that the result of their generosity will be a good one for them, but that's not the reason why they do it. The reason why they're giving is completely focused on their love for the person to whom they're giving. And that's it. It's not thinking of anything for themselves, either in the short term, back from the person who they're giving, or in the long term, in terms of a good karmic result. Then the sixth way that they're not attached is that not only do they not have any overt avarice or miserliness, but they don't even have any latent predispositions toward these things. They don't even have any latent miserliness that can sort of come up at some time. They've completely eradicated it altogether. Because it's said that when the bodhisattvas reach the bodhisattva grounds, then they have no more mental afflictions. You know, they've completely done away with what is called the obscuration of mental afflictions. It's said that there are two obscurations to attaining enlightenment. And one is the klesha obscuration, and the second one is the obscurations, what are called the cognitive obscurations. And realizing emptiness directly means that you're done with the klesha obscurations, that you have no more mental afflictions. Only what you have left are obscurations towards omniscience, meaning that you still perceive things in a dualistic way during the post-meditative state, and so you don't have the completely realized mind of the Buddha. So the way this works is that the bodhisattvas, when they're meditating, can rest in emptiness and realize emptiness directly, but when they get up, they still have dualistic appearances until they attain enlightenment. And in stages, these dualistic appearances are cleared away, and this at the same time clears away their obscuration, their cognitive obscurations. But what they do have in the post-meditative state is the complete certainty that their experience is just illusory, just dreamlike. They have absolutely no thought in their mind of anything being real. So at the same time, they're experiencing dualistic appearances, they never waver from their knowledge and their certainty that it's all just an illusion. But since they've completely done away with all the mental afflictions, the kleshas, then they have not even any latent predispositions towards avarice. And then the final way that they're free of attachment involves their wisdom, in the sense that they are not attached to any of the three spheres of their act as being real. So the three spheres are the person who is giving, the person to whom it is given, and the object that is given. And the bodhisattvas don't have any clinging to any of these things as being real. So for them, that's direct experience. They don't have to consciously remind themselves anymore. They just know that inherently. For us, when we practice the first five paramitas, what's important is to bring in this wisdom aspect, which is, in whatever you do, you always try to remember that the person who's doing it, ourselves, and who we're doing it for, and what we're doing, is all just like a dream. There's nothing real about it. And in this way, this combines the practice of the accumulation of merit and the accumulation of wisdom together. Any questions about that? Any thoughts? Yeah.
So, is it appropriate to practice generosity in the way that it's described? I mean, realizing that you've now become, you know, obvious about what it's obvious. But I mean, if we haven't reached that point, is it still wise to be generous?
Mm-hmm. And that's a question that frequently comes up. And it's certainly true that we as ordinary beings possess the capacity to be incredibly generous in different situations, even though we haven't realized emptiness. I mean, you can just think of how many people risk their lives to save other people's lives. Right. So in essence, they're practicing the generosity of giving up their own body for the benefit of others, even though they haven't realized emptiness. We can still do that if it's an appropriate time. And Rinpoche also says, like, one really good way to sort of begin the practice of learning how to dissolve attachment to your body is, number one, do this practice of chud, which is practice of cutting through, where you visualize giving away the different parts of your body to making a big nice stew for all these evil spirits to be able to come and eat out of your own flesh and blood, and also to be an organ donor. Rinpoche says that again and again, that it's very good, it's a maya and a practice to, when you die, to be able to give away your eyes or your heart or whatever. And some people think that it's somehow conflicting with Vajrayana practice to do that, but it's not. In fact, it's not. You know, if you don't have a visualization of yourself as a deity, if at the time of death you have time to meditate on yourself as a deity, and then you dissolve that visualization, then what's just left are ordinary organs, and giving them away is a really good thing to do. Because there are teachings in the Vajrayana which say that you should leave the body undisturbed for a certain period of time, and that if you don't, then there's a danger that the consciousness will leave the body through an improper orifice, and then will take rebirth in one of the lower realms. But the fact is that once the body is completely cold, then the consciousness is gone. You know, like some realized teachers, like the 16th Karmapa and Trungpa Rinpoche and many others, Kala Rinpoche, they're able to stay in what's called a state of Tukdam, which is they're, even after they die, their consciousness rests in their heart. So you put your hand on their heart, then it's still warm. Okay, meaning the consciousness has not left the body, they're still meditating. And the body doesn't decompose even after death. But then at some point it leaves, the consciousness leaves, and then it just becomes like an ordinary corpse. But with our consciousness, if you haven't reached that state, then the consciousness leaves pretty quickly. And so there's no danger, you know, in terms of that action. So that would be the reason. But I think that in general, the more we develop our loving kindness and compassion, the more we'll see that we're actually able to give in more and more situations than we might think we had been before. So it's kind of like to get back to your question, I think that's like the underlying cause for being able to give in situations where you might think, well, is it smart for me to give here or not? If you develop this loving kindness and compassion, then I think we can do a lot more than we used to think we could. Yeah.
Ari, I was missing a word. You were using a word that you to describe the opposite of generosity, and I had not heard that word.
Mm-hmm. Avarice? It means like to be miserly.
Okay.
Just to not to want to give away your toys.
How do you spell that?
A-V-A-R-I-C-E. Any other questions? Okay, so then basically the other five descriptions of the five other practices are pretty much the same in terms of these seven types of attachment that the bodhisattvas are free from. The only thing to note is in terms of what the opposites to these different practices are. And so in the case of discipline, then the opposite of discipline is basically just failed discipline. When your discipline or your right conduct falters or wavers and you start to do things that are harmful to others, then that's the opposite of right conduct. And last kind of attachment that the bodhisattvas are free from with regard to discipline, then there's this notion that they're not only are they not attached to the three spheres of their activity, but they're also not attached to their discipline as being a Hinayana type of discipline. So it's good to know the difference between Hinayana discipline or ethics and Mahayana ethics. And the difference is that basically Hinayana ethics is premised on the notion that you don't harm anybody else. That's sort of the underlying motivation of it, is that you practice conduct that does not harm others. But in the Mahayana, the discipline is to help others. So whatever you do, you're motivated by helping others. And this broadens the scope of permissible conduct and in fact required conduct, so that whereas in the Hinayana discipline, for example, it's out of bounds to kill because that's harming someone, in the Mahayana there are many, many stories of how the Buddha killed other beings, you know, sometimes to save others. And the most famous is the story of when he was a ship captain and there was this this sort of pirate who came along and was going to kill everybody else on the ship who happened to be a bodhisattva, and he would experience, he would have, if he had done that, he would have gone into the hell realms for an incredibly long period of time, and by killing him, the bodhisattva accumulated one whole eon of merit, you know, just by that action. And similarly, if we look at the 10, what are called the 10 virtuous actions, there are those involved with speech, and one of them is to tell the truth. But if in order to benefit somebody else it requires you to lie, then you do it in the Mahayana. And because the fundamental basis of your motivation is to be a benefit to others. Any questions about that?
How do you make a good distinction whether you are actually doing help or actually whether you are hurting?
Mm-hmm.
I like this quote where it says, if you really want to help someone, you know, just don't try to help.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes we really have to help with each other.
Well, I think that it's just, I mean, we all obviously have lots of experience with interacting with people, and it just seems like it's something that you learn as you go along the way. But the basic thing here is the motivation. So if you look at your motivation, and your motivation is really pure, in terms of, even if it means that you withdraw contact from somebody or you don't overtly do something, if your motivation is really pure towards that person, then the action that you do will also be as pure. But to the extent that we have our own selfishness and fear mixed in with our motivation, then the action will be flavored by that.
So basically, whatever you do, when you're helping someone, you have to just make sure that it is totally clear from selfishness.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
Can you just go over this concept of primordial purity?
Yeah? Primordial purity. Okay.
One sentence.
Primordial purity means to be pure from the without beginning. So it means is naturally pure. You know, from the very outset, the nature of the, you know, primordial purity is used in the context of the nature of the mind. And it means that the mind has never been anything other than perfect. And we've taken beginningless time, we've taken birth in samsara, but all the way along our mind was always the same, completely pure. So that's that. Did you want to say
that? Yeah, this is a real sticky subject, I think, what Nilofer was talking about. If we look at our motivation and we're not bodhisattvas, and by definition, our motivation can't be very pure, it's corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
That can really hamstring you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you need to, I mean, probably everything that motivates me to do something kind for other people is because I'm getting a payoff for it in some way.
Right.
So,
well, it's just like,
yeah,
I mean, it's like Rinpoche said, we can only practice these in an approximate way.
But it's okay to practice
them. Yeah, we have to.
Yes.
And you have to train, and we have to make mistakes.
Yeah, so we're going to screw it up.
Right, exactly. But the basic way that we start to check ourselves is to look at this motivation, mm-hmm. and to be aware of what the actions are, you know, and when it's coming up that we see ourselves wanting a response, you know, or when we get attached to things and, you know, take pride in our good deeds or whatever it might be, just to start to be aware of that. And also to remember that, you know, this is like the good thing about this this aspiration prayer, which we sing at the end, which is, you know, I mean, when we act, even if we think we try to do good, we might end up making a bad connection. So we make this aspiration prayer that for everybody who with whom we have any type of connection, may their final result be good. And so it's kind of, I think it's, you know, expressing an understanding that we just do your best and don't worry too much about it. Just keep... There's one saying that Rinpoche often says, which is, I'm wrong and wrong again, and I walk on the right path.
That's nice. That's nice.
Yeah.
So then, in a sense, it may be maybe more detrimental to our path or practice if we allow fear or hesitation to stop us from helping in a potential situation. In a situation where we see there might need to be some help, but we're unsure, you know, we realize that our motivations may be impure, or we don't know if it's really going to help.
Right.
And it's better to make the effort than to allow fear and hesitation to seep in.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. It's sometimes it's hard to generalize because sometimes it's good to take a look at the situation before you rush in, right? But basically, what we can do is we can always make the aspiration that whatever we do will be of benefit. And we can always have that. You know, we can't be sure about what our conduct is going to lead to because we don't have the completely skillful means, but we can always make the aspiration that whatever we do, it's going to be the best for this person, that it's going to be a means for us to develop our wisdom, realizing the nature of the situation and also our compassion and all of our, you know, the good qualities. And then we just have to do it and see what happens. And that's how we gain experience.
Sorry, to harp on primordial purity again. Mindfulness. Can you be mindful of that sense of primordial purity, or is it? I mean, because we're talking about looking at purity.
Well, for us, I mean it's still an abstract image in our minds in terms of what that actually is, and then the realization of that is what makes you a noble bodhisattva. So at this point, we're mindful of, in a progressively subtle way, of what primordial purity is, and remember it again and again, and to first gain certainty that that is in fact the nature of the mind, and then to remember it again and again, and to meditate within that certainty. That's how we meditate as ordinary beings. We get certainty in it, and you rest in that. Okay, so then the next one is patience. And there are two sort of opposites to patience. One is anger, and the second is bearing a grudge, holding some type of malicious feeling somewhere below the surface. So those are the ones that the bodhisattva is not attached to. And it's also interesting to think about how they're not attached to a limit to their patience. Because this is how we normally are, and we think, okay, this I can't take anymore. Now I have to do something. And bodhisattvas don't act that way. They may decide that it's time to display wrath, as Rinpoche talked about yesterday, but it's not a reaction. It's not because they've lost their cool. You know, it's a decision that it's time to be, you know, to show something. But the underlying sense of patience never disintegrates.
Maybe it comes to me with anger at the same time, but as long as there's differentiate the anger and the decision, I guess you're okay. You don't follow the anger, but you're doing the action based on the decision. There may be that lingering anger which you just don't dwell on as an actual reaction.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just that they're not acting when they're displaying anger. They're not acting out of anger. Their patience never decreases.
Okay.
And no matter what harm is done to them, they're able to endure it quite happily. But they might decide to display anger to be a benefit to somebody else. But they never say, they never think, oh, now I've practiced enough patience. Now that's it. Yeah.
So I always used to think, when I get a light, then I don't have to worry about being pissed off because I won't have any of these negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And what just came to me that's kind of unpleasant is that, there's always this goal, when I get enlightened, then I'll feel patient and I'll be easily patient because there won't be a source of any negative emotions. And it sounds like that one of the ways we do that, it isn't that we get something, we don't get enlightened. We just stop doing all that stuff and stop holding on to all those things that are getting in the way, which implies that the way I become patient is that I let go of all this, my anger and my grudges and all these painful negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to get this enlightenment blast that's going to blow that stuff away. I'm going to have to melt it away through painful practice.
Well, I mean, there are different, we're sort of talking about the result here, but if you want to talk about the way to develop, patience and the way to practice it, that's sort of a different question, but briefly, you can say that there are a few different methods that you can use. One is the most basic one is you always just meditate on the opposite of it. So if you feel angry, you just try to generate loving kindness and compassion. Or you can use the method that is talked about in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is when somebody throws a rock at you and it hits you on the head, then you try to find a locus for your anger. Are you going to get angry at the rock? Well, the rock didn't do it by choice. Then you have to get angry at the hand that threw the rock. But that didn't make the decision either. It was the person. But the person too, they didn't act, independently. They were overcome by anger. So if you want to get mad at anything, you have to get mad at the anger. But the anger is only comes from the ignorance of not realizing that anger only leads to suffering. So then you have to get mad at the ignorance. So what we see is there's really nothing, we like focus on one other person who's doing this to us, but as soon as we examine it, that just breaks down. And so there's no longer any reason to be angry. Also, when something bad happens to us, then it's great because it's clearing away our karma. We never ever have to experience the bad result of that action again. That's another thing. But every time we experience suffering, it's the elimination of a negative result of some past action. So never have to go through it again. That the result of that, because you think that the only reason why something bad happens to us is because we did something in the past to deserve it. No other reason. And so, let me just finish this. And so these are different sort of more conceptual methods for meditating on, cultivating patience. You can also meditate on emptiness in the different ways that Rinpoche has been teaching about how the person who's harming you is really not one or many. There is no person, there is no self being harmed for the reasons that we've gone over. Then there's no reason, if there's nobody being harmed, there's no reason to be angry either. And then finally, there's the most direct method, which is more like the Mahamudra style of meditation, which is you just look directly at the essence of your anger. Which in Mahamudra is taught to be clarity, emptiness, undifferential. And there's a beautiful poem by Pachal Rinpoche where he sort of goes through, it's in this book, Flight of the Garuda, which some people might have seen, but he goes through and he says, what is generosity? Generosity is meditating on the essence of miserliness. What is patience? There is no higher practice of patience than to meditate on the essence of anger. No. So in that sense, to get back to your question, I mean, there's nothing that needs to be cleared away. You know, the anger itself doesn't inherently exist. And realizing that is the highest practice of patience. And that's good to know, because a lot of times it can really feel like a struggle, you know? Like you feel like, oh, I've got this anger, I've got to feel love, I've got to develop more love, you know? And it's like, oh, I can't do it, then you get more frustrated. But just to realize that the anger doesn't really exist in the first place is a complete release right there. And then the problem's over.
Can I ask a slight... You know, I can see how over eons you will let go of all these pain emotions in your past, anger and grudges and all the ones that we know about. It's really uncomfortable. Is this method that we have, is this Gardner method, kind of a shortcut? I mean, if you realize the nature of mind, then, I mean, you just cut the chase, realize the nature of mind, and then you don't have to worry about your negative emotions anymore?
Yeah, because you know that there's nothing to let go of. There's nothing to get rid of.
And that's a doable task.
It sounds like you have to say that again.
There's no one to do it.
That was a cheap reframe.
Yeah. No, but that's what it's really about. Okay. Did you want to? But I mean, that's exactly what, you know, Rinpoche is saying. He's saying, like, it seems really hard and it seems like it takes a long time. The only way we can get over that, not, you know, our natural reaction to that, you know, three eon path that's sitting in front of us is this realization of emptiness. That's why the wisdom, that's why it's so important.
Do you have any sense of how many eons we've come so far?
Many, many more. Many more than that. Yeah.
Just in line with that, because I've heard many teachers say you can do it in one lifetime, and I, at times I feel this pressure to do it in one lifetime. Yeah.
Yeah, the Bodhisattva doesn't care, because they're perfectly happy to come and help as many beings as they can. They have no concern about how long it takes, because it's like when you eat an ice cream cone, you're not looking at your watch seeing like, oh, I have to eat this for another 10 minutes. You know, it's because you like to eat it that you're just doing it. It's like that. And wherever the Bodhisattvas go in samsara, it's like a big party. You know, so they're not looking at their watch saying like, oh shit, I have to stay here for another hour. They love it.
Why is there a lot of emphasis on like, oh, you did it in one lifetime, like more
Mm-hmm. Well, that is to emphasize the power of the Vajrayana methods and to cause us to give incredible respect to them and to venerate them and not to take them lightly. Because once you get into that type of practice, then doing that can cause a lot of problems if you sort of disregard it or don't treat that with respect or the Lama with respect and things like that. To cause us to appreciate the Vajrayana. But to say that someone can do it in one lifetime is true if you have the diligence of Milarepa. And the commitment of Milarepa, you know, to be able to sit for 11 months with the lamp above your head meditating night and day, to be able to endure everything that Marpa made him do without ever having a single negative thought towards his guru. And when, if we can do like that, then we can attain enlightenment in one lifetime. On the songs of Milarepa. Well, the songs have been translated by, you know, Garma Chang, and I haven't really looked at that translation too much, but in Milarepa's life story, which was translated by Lobsang Lalumpa, that's a pretty good translation, and if you haven't read that, then it's really good to read that. And there are a lot of songs in there.
How is it known whether someone is a bodhisattva or not?
Well, like one example is this one, is if, you know, from, we can't see the bodhisattva's mind, but if you can see somebody who's happily giving away their flesh and blood, then you know that they're a bodhisattva.
I mean, that's not the only thing that they do.
No, but I mean,
so
yeah.
How would you, just like, if you see ordinary people, you see ordinary people all the time, how do you recognize their bodhisattva, or how do they recognize, or like when a bodhisattva is mm-hmm. born, do they already know that they're there for bodhisattva during their childhood, or do they come to that realization when they reach teenage or something, or
mm-hmm.
how does it happen?
It's just like Rinpoche said, I mean, it's inconceivable to us, you know, what they're, and what they might say is, what they might tell us might be something different from the way it really is, you know, I mean, because they're trying to teach us to see that everybody is equally, has this Buddha nature, and everybody's equally good, no matter who they are. So I have no way to answer those questions. But in terms of, like for us, in terms of what's important, maybe like finding a teacher or whatever, judging somebody like that, then the best thing I ever heard about that was Chukin Yima Rinpoche said, you just find somebody who has 50% more wisdom than you and 50% more compassion than you. And that's your teacher. I mean, it's not that difficult.
Okay.
Then we get to diligence. The definition of diligence is really nice. The definition of diligence is to delight in virtue. So again, there's no sense of a struggle. You know, obviously, some things that bodhisattvas do and that we do on the path are very difficult, but they're done with the motivation of enjoying them, of embracing them. Because again, the diligence here is pointing yourself in the direction of being a benefit to others. And when we develop loving kindness and compassion, then that's easy. It's easy to delight in virtue. And so again, the opposite of that is laziness. And laziness is when we have the opportunity to do something that's a benefit, but we don't. You know, we don't want to do it.
One question there. Okay. If you have a choice between like benefiting something or benefiting others or benefiting yourself in the path of enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
like you're going to maybe go to a retreat, or you're going to go to Africa, feed the hungry.
Right.
Which one should be?
Right. Now that's important. It's important to know that the practices of listening, reflecting, and meditating are, the practice of Dharma is of benefit to others. Even if not in an immediate way, it certainly is in terms of laying the long-term causes of being able to really be of benefit to others, which is through the combination of wisdom and compassion. So in terms of we who have to live in the modern world, then what Rinpoche often says is that we, you know, when we work, we do, when we're sort of in the world, we do whatever we can to be a benefit to others, constantly remembering that it's all just like an illusion. And then when you can take vacation, for a few weeks or a month or however, then you go to a solitary place and you do your practice. You know, if you, and however much, you know, however that balance works, but that you do both. You don't forsake one for the other. You don't eliminate one for the other.
But in case you had to choose between the other, I mean, like a totally hypothetical question, like in the next 3 months you have the choice of this versus the other one, which one should you value more?
Well, I mean, I think that's a decision that you have to make in the context of, you know, with a teacher and what your practice is and those kinds of things. It's hard to say, like, to generalize one way or the other. But if your motivation is good, then either one will come up. Okay, so that's diligence. Then the opposite of meditative stability, which is the fifth transcendent perfection, is distraction. And distraction is defined in different ways on different levels of the path. For the Shravaka meditations and some of the Mahayana meditations, then any sense activity, any activity of the senses moving towards outer objects is distraction. And so in their meditations, they really try to shut down sense activity and just completely draw the mind in and rest it in. But in Mahamudra meditation, certainly, and even meditations in the Mahayana that more bring in emptiness, then the distraction is really just to, is when you forget that distractions aren't real. That's distraction. But as long as you remember that anything that's happening on the outside or the inside is just a manifestation of appearance emptiness or clarity emptiness in the terms of thoughts, then there's no distraction. And then the more stable the practice gets, the more distractions, the better, because then you have more realization. Which is why it said, the more thoughts, the more wisdom. Now, so the more understanding of reality we have, then the less problem there is with external things or internal things. And the last of the six is, any questions about that? The last of the six is wisdom. And the opposite of wisdom is to fall into the extreme of either realism or nihilism. So we all have intelligence, and wisdom really just means to be intelligent, to be able to analyze things. And so there's worldly wisdom, and there's wisdom realizing emptiness, examining emptiness, which transcends the world. That's the basic division that's made. But when we're not focused on emptiness properly, and we fall into an extreme of thinking that things are real, or the extreme of thinking that there's nothing, then that's the opposite of this particular paramita. So let me just say one thing. So basically, the way to prevent that from happening is to think about the two truths in a proper way. So the basic way to think about ultimate truth, or to understand it, is that it transcends all conceptual fabrications. And whether you say it exists or it doesn't exist, and both of those don't apply. So there's no way to fall into any type of extreme maintaining that type of understanding, because we know that whatever our conceptual description is, no matter how subtle, it's still off the mark. And then in terms of the relative, then it's just a matter of remembering that appearance and emptiness are undifferentiable from each other. So we certainly have appearances, and nobody can deny that. At the same time, it appears it's not really there. And so the remembering that there's an appearance prevents you from falling into the extreme of nihilism, where you just deny everything. And knowing that the appearance doesn't inherently exist prevents you from falling into the extreme of realism. And this is where all these examples come into play. The example of the moon on a pool of water, of a dream. And when Rinpoche tells us about all these modern examples, you know, like email and internet and everybody laughs, then it's funny, but it's important for us not to dismiss those things, because he really thinks that it's great to live in the modern world because you have all these examples of emptiness. I mean, in Melbourne, we went into a casino, and he had the best time because there are all these like fountains with all these different lights, you know, and you have the slot machines and there's all these lights going, and you have, you know, all these televisions all over the place and big mirrors and all this stuff, you know, like in big shopping malls they have all these things, or Times Square in New York City. And it's incredible to just go in there and see all, watch television, and if we can just look at all these things that are happening on television and just train ourselves and think, that person's not real, that person's not real. And this, all this stuff that's happening is just like an illusion. Then watching television is very beneficial for Dharma practice.
You forgot the four columns of fire in front of the casino.
No, we didn't go to that one. We have to go back.
Same casino.
But yeah, I mean, so that's, there, like Rinpoche often says, like in Tibet, they would, if they could get one tiny little piece of a mirror, you know, for certain practices you need a mirror to be able to look at yourself. If you could get one tiny sliver of it, you were lucky. But here, you know, they have full-length mirrors. You know, you can just dance in front of the mirror and just look at this reflection and see that it's just appearance emptiness. And then take that understanding and apply it to everything. So he's really trying to impress upon us how lucky we are to live in this advanced age where we have all of these things which are just mere appearances due to the coming together of causes and conditions, and to use them to help us on our path. So yeah.
I get a little confused when they talk about the extremes that you can fall into if you don't have a proper view. Sometimes they're described as eternalism and nihilism, even mm-hmm. some realism and nihilism. And sometimes the terms seem to describe very different things. Certain teachers seem to use the term nihilism to describe a materialist view, whereas when you say realism, I would equate that to a materialist view, and nihilism would seem to be sort of an extreme of believing that emptiness has no qualities whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I want to be sure I understand what you mean by the two extremes, I guess, and whether the way Rinpoche uses it is different that you know of.
Yeah. Well, they're different. I mean, if that's a good point, and they do mean different things at different times. Mm-hmm. The most literal translation you could say was permanence, would be permanent. Mm-hmm. That's the literal word that's used. And then the other word is like to cut off, like cessation. And I think that the origin of the words comes from the different types of other philosophies that existed at the same time as Buddhism. The Hindu schools believed in a permanent self that was unchanging. And then there were other traditions that believed that there's only this lifetime, and that they believed that the self somehow was cut off and dissolved into nothingness. Okay, so that's one level. A second level, which Nagarjuna talks about, is any time that you think existence, that's the extreme of what I'd say call realism. And any time you think non-existence, that's the extreme of nihilism. But it's certainly very good to, as you pointed out, to see how a materialist view is nihilistic, because in the modern world, sort of the common perception is that there's no, you know, there's no God, there's no, there's just, mind just comes from the elements. I mean, we're just this body. There's nothing else beyond that. And then we disintegrate and we, you know, that's it. There's no path, there's no future life, there's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no nothing. You know, this is it. And so that, in that sense, a belief that in true existence leads to a belief in nihilism, because you think that this life is real and you think that this body is real and everything that happens is real, but then there's nothing on either side of that. Okay, but the Buddhist view is that there's no cessation. So it's just this life and the next and the next and the next and the next, but all of it is just like a water moon. It's just like a rainbow. And it's because they don't think that this body is something truly existent that they know, and this mind is truly existent that they know, it depends upon causes and conditions. And so then you say, well, what are the causes and conditions of consciousness? A previous moment of consciousness, not the body, but the consciousness itself. So the body ceasing does not lead to the cessation of the mind. It just goes and produces another existence. And all the habitual tendencies continue from lifetime into lifetime. And so in that way, it's very good to see that, because it's easy for people to say that emptiness is the view of nihilism, but in fact, materialism is the view of nihilism, not emptiness, because emptiness allows everything to happen and allows everything to continue from one life to the next to the next. It allows, because emptiness and dependent arising are, as Rinpoche said, they're basically talking about the same thing. So good action leads to a good result. If you don't experience it this lifetime, you've got to experience it at some point, because the causes and conditions are there. They'll just happen in a future lifetime. And so this view of emptiness actually allows our view to be much more expansive and understanding and much more broad. It's not a narrow or denying view, it's a broadening view. Sure.
What do they say as the origins of causes and conditions, and what do they say about why the causes and conditions are the way they are?
Well, the origins of causes and conditions, all you can say are other causes and conditions. You can never find any... No, but it's true. I mean, you can't... If you could say there was an origin, then that would have to be the beginning, and that point would necessarily not have arisen from causes and conditions.
Then why do we have this eternal emptiness, and then there's this thing that looks like a mud of appearances?
Mm-hmm.
And these appearances are actually separate from the emptiness, but they are obscurations.
No, the appearances, there was never a time that emptiness was clear and then the mud comes. You know,
well, but still, even if they were both from the beginning, from the eternity, they are represented as two separate things, or, you know, some bright light and this cloud covering it.
Right. Well, that's just, that again is like a conventional explanation to give us some notion of, some way to get a grasp on it, like to know that there are stains to purify, to know that the nature of mind is pure. These things are taught as if they are separate. But in fact, the nature of reality is undifferentiable. They don't exist as separate entities at all. It's just like when you snap your fingers, then you can analyze different qualities of that sound. You can say that it's produced by causes and conditions, and you can say that it's impermanent. These two, right? So you can notice these different qualities, but in terms of the sound itself, the qualities don't exist apart from each other. There's no separation. It's only our conceptual mind that's creating the separation.
Actually, what they're doing is they're not negating the reality of the appearances, but the appearances are more like, how do you say, not permanent within themselves. Like a flower blooms, dies, you know. So, you see what I mean? It's not stable stream, but it is more choppy water. So, thus, you cannot rely on any point on that choppy water.
Well, it sort of depends on the stage of the view, because some sort of the lower schools start out saying that, yeah, there is this continuum of events, there is this stream, there is this flow, even though the individual events within the flow are not real, there is this constant flow and type of continuum. But then as you get more and more into it, you see that they start to even refute the notion of there being a stream or not a stream. You know, both, any type of conceptual notion can't grasp the nature of reality. That's the main point.
We've kept our for like an hour now. I really think we have a way. Unless somebody has a burning question, we probably
don't
give a break.
You guys get a break too.
Thank you.
It's time for tea, so let's dedicate the merit. Gyewa di gyewo kun sonam yeshe tozone sonam yeshe le jumwa damba kun yito pa shu. Why don't we sing this prayer three times? The prayer for the sentient beings we have a good and bad connection. All you sentient beings I have a good or bad connection with, as soon as you have left this confused dimension, may you be born in the West in Sukhavati, and once you're born there, complete the Bhumis and the past. All you sentient beings have a good or bad connection with, as soon as you have left this confused dimension, may you be born in the West in Sukhavati, and once you're born there, complete the Bhumis and the past. All you sentient beings I have a good or bad connection with, as soon as you have left this confused dimension, may you be born in the West in Sukhavati, and once you're born there, complete the Bhumis and the past. Thank you.
Is there any meaning, particularly for the Sukhavati?
Yeah. Sukhavati, yeah. Sukhavati is Dewa Chen. It's the Western Buddha realm of Amitabha.
Why in the West in Sukhavati?
Yeah.
Why is it in the West?
Why in the West? Why not in Sukhavati?
Why in the West of Sukhavati?
In the West, Sukhavati is to the West.
East or
In the West in California.
Right. Exactly.
It can be born in...